Hey everybody, this is John Barrowman, and you're listening to The Happiness Patrol. Ha ha ha.
Hey everybody, and welcome back to The Happiness Patrol. We are at episode number 128, and today we are going to be reviewing, well, not really reviewing, but discussing,
reminiscing about.
You know, that's a very good reminiscing. We're going to talk about the New Who series, which is basically anything from 2005 to current Who. And basically what we're talking about is a little RTD era versus the Stephen Moffat era. Both men, amazingly talented people, both with uniquely different styles. And since we don't have enough time before our new doctor comes on the scene, because we're recording this on the 12th of August, and it won't be long now, 23rd is just around the corner, we will not have time to do... Thank you. We will not have time to do all four of these doctors, three of these doctors. Three, four? Three and a half? I don't know. Anyway...
We're talking about the previous three.
That's right. You know, we can argue how many doctors there are a little bit later. You know why, Nancy?
Why?
Because the Happiness Patrol starts now. So yeah, so today we're going to talk about a little RTD. We're going to talk a little Stephen Moffat. We're going to take 2005 to 2014 and combine it for you and condense it for you, so it's easier to digest. Correct, team?
Yes.
Yippers.
Joining us today, all the way from Canada. Oh, Canada, is Mr. Charles Martin. Hello.
Ooh, that's right.
It's good to have you here.
Thank you.
And we also have not too terribly far from you, in as the crow flies, Nancy from San Francisco. Nancy,
yep. Yay!
Yay! Pacific time zone rules.
Yeah, there you go. And Michelle, unfortunately, is out today. She has some things she had to take care of. But I'll playing the part of Michelle today will be Lewis. So.
God.
Yeah, right.
Are you going to go on the paleo diet?
Fuck that paleo diet. Shit. I'll eat anything that moves. So
just can do everything.
Well, that
bigger.
That sounds pretty paleo to me.
Yeah, really.
God. So anyhow.
Got your spear ready?
My spear.
Oh, gator. You could go spear gator. That would be really paleo, wouldn't it?
There you go. God. Florida paleo.
Jesus. Tastes just like chicken.
Uh-huh.
Well, in Florida, the paleo diet is called the tanio diet because there's no pale people there.
What a bet. Have you seen my legs lately, Chad?
TMI.
Have you seen my legs? You haven't seen this much white meat since Thanksgiving.
Oh! In 2005, something amazing happened for every Doctor Who fan around the globe, and that is... Phil Collinson and Russell T. Davies teamed up and brought Doctor Who back to the screen in England. And not only in England, of course, to the States, too. And really, it didn't take too terribly long for Chris Eccleston to make us believe that he is the Doctor. And the reason being, because if it's not on the script, it ain't on the stage. And Russell T. Davies basically... made that happen. Now, Nancy, you've read this book about Russell T. Now, what is the name of it?
It's called The Writer's Tale, and it actually came out of an email conversation between Russell T. Davies and Benjamin Cook, who was a writer for Doctor Who magazine.
Right.
And they just started corresponding back and forth when RTD was in the midst of writing Series 4. And they ended up realizing that it was something that other people might want to read. So they kept going. I think it had started out as an interview for Doctor Who magazine, and they just didn't stop.
Huh.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting because you really get a lot of insight into how RTD wrote things. And I came out of it with a much better understanding of his process. Uh-huh. And I understand a lot more of the criticisms about RTD, but right. I, you know, being a writer myself occasionally, I can totally see how his point of view and right. why he did it that way. And right. he had a hell of a lot on his plate. Anyway, now, yes, I am an RTD apologist. But but you know what I think is really, really important to remember about RTD is that if it wasn't for him, we would not be here right now. We would not be talking about Doctor Who because he had been a hot commodity.
Yeah, he had done, what was it? He had done Queer as Folk.
Queer as Folk, which was a big hit. It was a big hit in Britain, and then they remade it over in the U.S. because it was a big hit.
Oh, I didn't realize that. I didn't realize
Oh,
that.
Yeah. They did an American remake of it, and it was yep. really popular.
Uh-huh.
Yep. And so he was a very hot commodity. And BBC, he wasn't writing for the BBC. He was writing for other production.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Uh-huh.
And the BBC really wanted him because he was such a hot commodity. And when he was negotiating with them, he said, sure, I'll come write stuff for you, but there's this one stipulation I have. Will you let me bring back Doctor Who?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And that's why we have Doctor Who.
Let's also mention Julie Gardner, who is instrumental yes. in getting this done. She's responsible for them taking it to Cardiff and basically getting the legwork done.
Right.
So yeah. She deserves
a lot.
Now, she deserves a plaudit as well.
During the Eccleston era, was the production in Cardiff at the time, or had it not
yes.
yet moved to Cardiff?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
No, it's always been in Cardiff.
Oh, I did yeah. not realize that. For some reason, I thought that they had moved it like halfway through the Eccleston era.
You're thinking that they changed studios.
Is that the deal?
They moved into they had originally started off in just generic BBC studios in Wales, and then moved to a specially built facility to handle these big budget, expensive shows because more of them were coming to being created uh-huh. in Wales, such as Torchwood.
Oh, neat. Neato.
Well, Torchwood didn't happen yet.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
not yet.
Yeah.
Now, Archie. So, Russell T, he left after David Tennant decided to leave. Now, do we know any more about that? Or do we have any more insight about
why he was tired? He was tired and uh-huh. he wanted to move on. He'd been doing it for what?
5 years.
4, 5 years? Yeah, I was thinking it was 5 years. And, you know, especially having read through The Writer's Tale, that man was working his ass off to get that show done. He did a lot of rewriting of scripts. He wrote a lot of scripts himself. He was very actively involved. He was living this 24/7.
Yeah.
And, you know, that wears on you after, you know, 5 years.
Also, it should be mentioned that sometime later, after he left Doctor Who, his partner became very ill.
That's true.
And that's why there's not been any further Torchwood.
One thing I like about his style is that he is very character-driven. And the characters definitely drive the focus of the story. It's not situational. It's definitely character. So I know RTD, like myself, is a big fan of Joss Whedon, and his stories are very character driven, and he has those long story arcs, and he's not afraid to kill off beloved characters and all that great stuff. And if RTD had been able to get Joss Whedon to write for Doctor Who, that would have been amazing.
Holy crap.
I know.
So Russell T had a lot of things on his plate, and personally and professionally, and I guess that's why he left. Now, what do you think he took with him that we probably will not see in Doctor Who anymore.
He has very fully formed characters, and he, in his mind, has a whole backstory for them. And the way the characters progress from the beginning of their story, their personal character arc to the end, you see maturity. I mean, Mickey, I think, is a perfect example of this because when you first meet Mickey, he's not doing anything particularly special. He's just kind of, an ordinary guy. He's kind of, when he first sees Rose and the doctor in the TARDIS, he's kind of like, this is too crazy for me. I'm out of here,
Yeah.
Yeah. But by the end, he's a freedom fighter. He's gone to the other dimension. He's kind of badass. And, he's found his purpose in life. And I think, at the start, he had no purpose in life. And to a certain extent, Rose was the same way.
Right. Very much.
By the end, it just kills me. The speech she gives at the end of in Parting of the Ways, when they're sitting in the chip shop, and she talks about how the doctor has shown her a better way to live and how to, think about humanity and try to help other people. It's like, wow. I mean, you can just in that one season, you see a huge development in Rose's character from, the shop girl in Rose. And that is what I adore about RTD, and I really kind of miss in the Moffat era. I don't see that kind of really deep and meaningful character development and story arc for a character.
Uh-huh. So you think we won't see as much, or you think we don't see as much backstory character development as we would like to see? Or maybe it's just a different approach that Stephen Moffat has toward character development than Russell T. has. What do you think, Chaz?
He certainly does introduce very different companion-y sort of characters and give them very complicated backstories, which I think is a legit criticism in some ways. But Amy...
some people like that.
Yes. Amy, I thought, was a very interesting character because she was both broken and healed by the Doctor. And that's a very unusual angle to take.
Uh-huh.
That the little girl that we first met in the first season became a very psychologically damaged person because of the abandonment.
But we sort of saw that in Donna also.
Yes, but Donna had a family. Donna had support. Donna to me was like a much more beautifully developed Rose story in that she started off just treading water basically in her life and then became something so much greater. And then of course, that terrible, terrible ending. And by terrible, I mean fantastic.
Uh-huh. I do like the way RTD wrote female characters much better than the way Moffat does. Moffat, for Moffat, women are people who things happen to. And for RTD, women are people who affect change in the world.
Uh-huh.
His focus in writing, again, was about character. And there was one thing I read in his book that just really hit home with me. He said it was early in his writing career that he had been writing a scene with two characters talking.
Uh-huh.
And I can't remember if it was because someone asked him to do it or because he decided it was something he should do. But they were talking about a thing. I think it was like a divorce or something. And he decided that they were going to not talk about the divorce. They were going to talk about other things, but through the other things they were talking about, you got the story that this was a broken relationship.
Uh-huh.
And I just thought that was fascinating, that you could write something without being overt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there's a subtlety to that that really excites me.
RTD, his companions like Rose, like Donna, even Martha Jones to an extent, had a lot more depth and you cared about them a lot more, especially Rose. I mean, come on. I mean, I can't even think of another companion that moved me as much as Rose's character development did, other than maybe, say, Sarah Jane Smith, you know.
I do want to point out that there is a segment of fandom that can't stand her.
Yes.
Oh, I know.
I am not one of these people. Uh-huh. Let me make that clear. But I see where they're coming from, and one of the things that you asked, what did Russell take with him?
Yeah.
That we've seen the back of. Uh-huh. And I think, especially now, I think the soap opera is finally over.
Yeah.
I do, I think the problem with Rose is that I think RTD was in love with her.
Yeah. He was in love with her.
Yeah, he was in love with his own creation. And uh-huh. I think when you're too close to it like that, your tendency is to overdo it. And I think that's what he did. I think he got a little too in love with her.
I agree. Although I want to say this first off and foremost, I absolutely loved Billy Piper's performance.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah.
That was a revelation, because when I heard she was cast, I knew who she was before she was in Doctor Who. And when I heard she was cast, I thought, this will be awful.
Uh-huh. A lot of people did.
So I brought that prejudice with me to the show, but she really acted her socks off on that show. And I also double plus loved her all over again in the 50th anniversary special, because uh-huh. she wasn't Rose, and yet
there was
an echo of Rose there, but it wasn't, but it was definitely a different character. Yeah. And I loved that.
Holy crap, what a great actress she is.
Yeah. Apparently, David Tennant and Billy Piper just hit it off immediately, and they were really good friends, and that was part of the reason.
And
that
are still.
You felt a lot of chemistry between them, because, and he had great chemistry with Catherine Tate, too. I mean, they were like best buds the whole time they were working together.
You could really tell. Now, when I saw the Christmas special, Runaway Bride, with Catherine Tate, I had no idea who Catherine Tate was. I had no idea, because, you know, being American and not really watching a lot of this British stuff, I didn't know who the hell she was. And I actually, quite honestly, I hated her in that special. I did not like her at all.
A lot of people didn't.
Yeah, but when they brought her back as a quote-unquote proper companion, the turnabout was so crazy, and I was like, what's going on? Is this even the same person? I think the way Russell T handled that was quite remarkable and very, very believable to me and a lot of fans.
Well, he had actually written a new companion for the Doctor for Series 4.
Uh-huh.
I believe, I think her name was Penny. He had written this character, and he was going to cast it. You know, he was like picturing, I think, a blonde and, you know, kind of sassy, you know, and he was saying, you know, I kind of like her to be sort of like Donna Noble, but, you know, we're never going to be able to get Catherine Tate to come back, so I'm just going to write this other character. And he, you know, he fleshed out this whole character, and then he found out Catherine Tate said, sure, I'll come back.
Holy crap, isn't that nice?
Yeah, and he was just thrilled. And actually, if you read the writer's tale, that happens during the course of their correspondence.
Uh-huh.
And so you see his excitement when she said she'd do it. And it's almost like you're there when he's experiencing it. It's great. If you're at all a Doctor Who fan and you like the RTD era, I highly recommend you read this book.
Cool, cool, cool.
Well, this was an important lesson I learned from Douglas Adams, to name drop. Every idea that you have, file it away. If you thought it was good, file it away. Just because you can't use it now doesn't mean you can't use it later.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes reuse it later.
That's true.
But yeah,
too.
Pretty much in those couple of paragraphs, he fleshed out what Donna was going to be.
Yeah.
But at that time, it was Penny.
Right.
So I think that's why we see a lot of that.
A lot of
that
change.
Evolution in Donna is he had personally evolved her character. And so I think it's justifiable because at the end of The Runaway Bride, she has changed.
Yeah.
She has
and
seen a greater
that's why,
world.
That's why she was so believable when she came back. And so much more acclaimed.
And Catherine Tate is a really good actress. I mean, to pull off the kind of comedy she did, you have to be a really good actress to pull off comedy. And she was able to make that transition from the Runaway Bride Donna to Series 4 Donna, I think, very well.
Yeah.
And I love Donna.
Thank God.
Well, you know, he did affect a number of transitions across the show. You mentioned Mickey earlier, and I think that's a perfect example. Even Rose's mom went from being the funny mom,
yeah, right,
the funny horny mom,
yeah,
to a real flesh and blood character who has to deal with these long absences,
yes,
of all that's left of her family.
Well, and, you know, Love and Monsters gets a lot of shit, but that's probably the best Jackie story.
Because I love that story. Yeah. I love that story.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people are very divided on it. I understand. I respect why, but I love that story for three reasons. One, it's just got some fantastic character development in it. Two, ELO.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
And three, finally a monster I can cosplay. Yeah.
Oh, God.
Well, and Shirley Henderson. I love Shirley Henderson. I've loved her for ages.
Well, yeah. You know, the cool thing about that is that we have not seen what had happened to those who have been left behind. Those like Rose's mom. You know, we have never seen what had happened. And like when, you know, when she comes back and she's like, where the hell have you been? You know, she had all the missing flyers out, you know, and she didn't realize how long she had been gone. I mean, that is one of those things as a classic Who fan, you'd be thinking, you know, in the back of your head when you're getting ready to go to sleep or something like that. Like,
oh, yeah.
Hey, I wonder whatever happened. I mean, what would their job be thinking? Like, or does he get them back, you know, before they left, or like just after, like 20 minutes after they left, like, you know, they went to lunch or something or whatever, you know, and you see that for the very first time. And that alone is enough to go, hey, Russell T, that's genius.
All those writers, you figure during the wilderness years, that's what they were laying awake at night thinking about. So, of course, they brought those back in their stories.
Yeah,
they were asking those same questions.
we should mention that for those of you who haven't read them, the new adventure novels from Virgin Publishing and the BBC novels that came afterwards really did a lot of bridging work and backstory, which is occasionally referenced in the new series.
Oh, yeah.
Not too much, but just a little. Like the Chelonians were mentioned as a throwaway line.
Oh, actually, speaking of throwaway lines, what I thought was hilarious, you know about the thing about the Chula?
Yes.
Yeah, it was a restaurant in Cardiff that the writers always used to eat at. There was a restaurant called Chula, and they had a dare to see who could come up with a way to use the word Chula in an episode first. And Moffat did it in The Empty Child.
Yeah.
It was a Chula warship.
Right. It's great. But actually, I'm glad you mentioned that episode, because I was just going to say your point about Russell being very character-oriented and the story just follows the characters and their reactions versus Stephen Moffat's approach of I'm going to dream up a story and then I'm just going to put people in it. You can see this clash of styles, and it worked very well when they were working together in Captain Jack, who is a fantastic character, but he's a bundle of very enjoyable traits. But he's not, the fact that they could just graft on that whole face of Bo nonsense tells you exactly how two-dimensional he was.
Well, okay, I got to say, okay, now, since we're talking about RTD, I have to say something about my absolute favorite episode of the whole entire new series, which is Utopia. And it's my favorite for so many reasons, but the number one is that conversation that Captain Jack has with the doctor, where he tells the doctor what's been happening to him since he last left him. And watch that. That whole scene is absolutely perfect, because you have the doctor and Jack talking and reminiscing about history. In the background, you've got Martha and Professor Yana listening.
Yeah.
And there's like five different things going on in that conversation. There's Martha understanding more about the doctor. There's the doctor understanding more about Captain Jack. There's Captain Jack, you know, getting to tell his story. And then you've got Professor Yana in the background getting this little spark in the back of his brain saying, this is all sounding kind of familiar. Why? Speaking of the RTD era, I really have to say something in defense of Helen Rayner. And I've been meaning to write an essay called In Defense of Helen Rayner, because you see so many people, you mention that name and they say, oh my God, Daleks in Manhattan. Oh, the Suntaran episodes. Oh, it's so awful. But you know what? I think the reason her episodes were not so great is because she wasn't the script editor on those.
Oh, really? Who was?
I don't know, but not her. But okay, you go down the list of the stories she script edited in the RTD era, and it reads like the list of all the best RTD episodes. Uh-huh. Let's go here. We have The Unquiet Dead, Dalek, The Empty Child, The Doctor Dances, Bad Wolf, Parting of the Ways, The Christmas Invasion, New Earth, School Reunion, The Girl in the Fireplace, Rise of the Cybermen, The Age of Steel, Army of Ghosts, Doomsday, Blink, Silence in the Library, Forest of the Dead, and Midnight. Yeah, I just love Helen Rayner. I think that she probably had the balls to say, you know what, this is working and this isn't working.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And she's a Doctor Who fan from way back, so she knew what had to be in it. So anyway, that's my defense of Helen Rayner.
Uh-huh. So she was script editor and also a writer as well.
He gave her some stories to write. And, you know, it's kind of a shame that there aren't more female writers on Doctor Who. But and she does get a lot of shit for those. And it's too bad. I think part of the problem is she was thrown a ball. It was like, here, you write this story. And he probably gave her, you know, the bones of it. And she had to go with his idea. I'm guessing. I don't know.
But you want to talk about Joss Whedon-esque. I thought Daleks in Manhattan was the most Joss Whedon-esque the story ever got, the series ever got.
Really?
Yeah.
How?
Well, first of all, sticking a musical number in for no reason.
did that once.
And once several plot threads that were all several plot threads that were all improbable, and but some really lovely characters and really getting the feel of the era correct. So I liked it.
Yeah, I the characters are great. The pig slaves, not so.
Yeah, well, anywho.
I just thought that was a typically demented. This is the thing that I can't stand about Who fans is that they instantly, when they see something they don't think works, they instantly forget that there's lots of things that don't work in Doctor Who.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah, that's true.
The pigmen is just another typically demented Dalek slave idea of which there have been many. It's no dumber than the Robo Men, for heaven's sakes.
The Robo Men.
Get over it. And they made a movie about them.
Hey, give a little respect to the Robo Men, okay?
No, man. Walking straight into the Thames to drown yourself because you can't stand living in anymore? That's awesome.
With all these amazing genius things that he's come, these elements of just pure, like, iconic Doctor Who, just as iconic as Canine or anything else in classic stories, you know, he also had these bits of, like, just equally, what the hell's going on here, you know? And so I think that's the reason that he gets so much shit, because when he's good, he is fucking great. But when he's bad, you're like going, you're scratching your head for a week, you know?
Well, you know, a lot of it is his writing style, because what he did is he would formulate all these ideas in his head, and he was a procrastinator. And he didn't actually write the shit down until the last minute. And I think when he wrote it down, it was like, oh, how am I going to get the Doctor out of this predicament?
As you mentioned that he's a very character-oriented writer, I always found him better and better the smaller the situation was. Does
yes.
that make sense?
Yes.
His big bombastic season endings usually left me pretty cold. Journey's End being an exception.
Yeah.
But when he's doing those little scenes like the Ninth Doctor and Blomfelfotch is I'm mispronouncing the name. Though, yeah, wasn't that dialogue insanely great?
What are you talking about again?
This in
Boomtown.
Boomtown. That was actually the first New Who I watched.
What?
And I think yes, Boomtown's the one. It's the return of the Slitheen.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
When they're going to destroy Cardiff. And that's where the rift happens.
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
And yeah, that lovely scene with the doctor and Blonde Felfotch Passimer Day Slidine.
Yes, that's it. Thank you. But I mean, all of that dialogue between them and the moral dilemma, all of that in The Unquiet Dead, where Rose is suddenly challenged in her moral belief system that dead bodies shouldn't be reanimated. When the situation is small, or when there's just a couple of characters talking, that is when RTD is always at his best, it seems to me.
So, you know, Chaz, I had totally forgotten, because it seemed like so long ago now, the beginning of the Matt Smith era, that people were very concerned about Stephen Moffat, even with his track record of writing Blink, for crying out loud. They were worried about him taking over the reins for Russell T.
Yeah. Yeah, like I said, there was a couple of people in the running for the job, I think, but you need somebody who is a successful television producer, and Stephen Moffat fit the bill. Huh. He also is, of course, a great fan of the show and wanted to bring an element that he didn't feel like had been exploited enough in the Russell Davis era, which is the timey-wimey-ness. This can get complicated because Stephen Moffat writes mysteries and wants more than anything else for you not to figure it out. And we'll throw in not just MacGuffins, but whole nonsensical plot twists if necessary to make sure that surprise ending is a surprise. He loves, that's the whole thing about him. He just loves big surprises.
You saw that in Curse of Fatal Death.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And so I understand and can respect that there's a contention point there, because Stephen Moffat, in order to make sense of what is going on, requires very careful viewing, maybe repeat viewing, and even then, there's still some dangling questions.
Well, you know,
even then,
with me, you know, when you say repeat viewings, that's, you know, that really hits home with me, because I can't tell you how many times I was like, whoa. A lot of that had to do with the rapid fire delivery of Matt Smith and his lines. Another part of that had to do with the simple fact that I'm not used to hearing British accents all the time, so I really have to go back and go, whoa, what the hell did he say? So so I was rewinding the old VHS tape a lot, just to get see. No, not VHS.
VHS tape?
I figured I'd throw my own timey-wimey in there for you.
Yeah. Are you Amish now?
No.
Is it VHS or Beta?
I don't think the Amish are allowed VHS machines. So... unless they're made of wood, I don't know, and it doesn't work on wood. So, but anyway, it's crazy, because like I think that maybe on purpose in a lot of ways. At first, I thought it was, because I thought, oh, they just want to sell the DVD, so you can watch it again and again, you know. And then I'm thinking, well, duh, that's me thinking very 1980s, like the VHS comment, you know, because like you do need to see, you need to pay attention to these small details to find out what the hell's going on, because the devil is in the details. When you hear these details and you see these details or notice them, it will give you the clues to where everything is going. And Chaz, I have never thought of him as a mystery writer before until you actually made that statement. I mean, yeah. And that is dead on. Nancy, what do you think?
I think Doctor Who in general is a mystery. I mean, there's always, I mean, it's structured in the way a mystery is structured. There's something weird going on. Usually almost every episode begins with the TARDIS landing somewhere and something weird is happening and you the audience and the doctor and the companion have to figure out what's going on and how to solve the problem. And that's the way a mystery story is structured too.
Stephen Moffat is just obsessed with you not guessing the ending.
Yes, right. He wants to be Agatha Christie. He wants to, you know.
He does.
I think he's channeling Agatha Christie. And okay, well, this is yeah, okay. Well, here you go. Mystery authors, you know, the Detection Club. I much prefer Dorothy Sayers to Agatha Christie, and I prefer RTD to Moffat for the same reason. Christie and Moffat are all about the puzzle and, you know, trying to fool the reader, where Sayers and RTD are more about the character and writing a story that happens to be a mystery.
The other thing, he said this in a quote, especially, it was about Girl in the Fireplace, but it applies to any of his episodes that he's written. And that is that every 10 minutes or so, something completely unexpected should happen, because he's got to keep the viewer. He's got to keep the viewer in. That's why that horse shows up on the spaceship.
Right.
I think a lot of that might have to do with writing to a younger, more sophisticated audience than, say, 30, 40 years ago.
Doctor Who has always technically been a children's show.
Right.
But it has also always been fairly sophisticated children's show.
Yes, absolutely.
If nothing else, the Sarah Jane Adventures reminded us that children's television is often dumbed down. And it's been shows like Doctor Who back, especially when it was more thought of as a children's show, and the Sarah Jane Adventures later that took that role. Mm-hmm. That reminds you that, no, children's television can be quite sophisticated. They're not idiots.
Yeah, right. You don't have to talk down to kids. You can talk to kids. You don't have to talk down to kids. Some of his stories with David Tennant were simply amazing to me, and not to mention, or at least we forget, his Christopher Eccleston stories. Which were just some of the most amazing.
The Empty
ever.
Child is just one of the scariest stories up until Blink comes along, which he also wrote.
Yeah.
They're some of the scariest, creepiest stories in the Doctor Who canon. Just wonderful.
And he has a certain way of bringing you in and making you identify with the situation. He has a wonderful thing, and Nancy, we've actually talked about this before, how he can take something very common that we take for granted in our lives all the time and make it scary as hell.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, the Girl in the Fireplace was the scary thing under your bed.
Right.
He wants to be the curly-headed love child of Agatha Christie and Stephen King. That's
yeah, I think he probably does, yeah.
I think I've nailed him. Anyway, but even take a less than stellar story of his, like The Beast Below.
Okay.
Right? First, you've got UK cities having their, and UK countries having their own spaceship. That's surprising idea number one. And then second surprising idea is the whole finding, you know, the mystery part, finding out why the ship's not vibrating, all that sort of thing, who this mysterious hooded figure is. And then at the end, you discover it's a space whale.
Space whale.
What? Yeah. It's just one curveball after another. He loves that kind of stuff. And just as Nancy said, he's kind of the opposite of Russell in terms of writing style, where he wants bonkers situations that he will put characters into. Russell goes the other way around and makes characters who then lead the story where it goes.
Well, bonkers is definitely right. Now, Matt Smith, how do you think he approached writing for such an actor as Matt Smith?
Well, I mean, this is the difficult thing, because Matt's a real box of delights, you know. I've seen him in some non-Doctor Who stuff where under different directors and doing different things, and he's totally different.
Yeah.
We've talked about Billy Piper earlier. She and Matt were in a couple of things together. One was her series, Diaries of a Call Girl, and the other one was The Ruby and the Smoke, where a very young Matt Smith plays Billy Piper's assistant.
Uh-huh.
Aha! And he is so low-key in those things. I saw Christopher in His Kind, which the TV movie he did between the first and second of his seasons. And that, again, completely different than Doctor Who. He's a very versatile performer, but definitely of the eccentric school that you would see from a Pat Troughton or a Tom Baker.
You know, and because of that, I would think that he would be just as typified as the Doctor, because of the same reason Tom Baker was, because of their performance was so eccentric and so over the top.
Well, over the top is well, I should, uh-huh. This is an American Britainism split here. Over the top in England is an insult to an actor.
Ooh, well, goodness.
It means you overplayed it. You're going broad or campy.
Right.
Rather than I know what you mean by it.
Well, campy is not far of a stretch, because I've talked to a lot of people at conventions and such, and mainly older Americans will tell me, I don't care too much for that new fella. I like Tom Baker. I like that curly or they'll say, I like that curly headed fella.
What do they say when they put their teeth back in?
They'll say,
hey, you kids today.
Yeah, exactly.
I remember when William Hartnell's TARDIS was paired with a telegraph.
So there's a split. And I, you know, being a Matt Smith fan, I love Matt Smith. I think he's great. But, like, it was very strange for me to hear people go, oh, well, I don't like that new guy. And I kept thinking, well, which new guy are you talking about? Because, you know, there's been three.
Yeah. It's always a new guy.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
That's what the show's about.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And you can make the argument, and I will, that that although Stephen meticulously, he is a mystery writer, and he meticulously sews up every plot line, every major plot line, at the end. But the end may be 3 years from now.
Oh, God.
So, I mean, there was a ton of stuff in those last, what were they called? Time of the Doctor, Name of the Doctor, the 50th anniversary special.
Shoe of the Doctor. Pants of the Doctor.
Yeah. All of those things together tie up many, many, many loose ends and undo certain things that we already saw in earlier seasons. But, there's lots of little details that you're like, but well, what about?
What do you think? What do you think, Nancy?
I think he has too many details. I just think he needs to take a few out. And I think I've said this before. It's like the stew that you keep putting extras. It's like maybe it needs a little thyme, maybe a little basil, maybe a little, you know, marjoram. You know, you just keep adding, and then you get.
I hear this a lot, of that he's too clever by half, and I think that's a fair criticism.
He thinks he's too clever by half.
Well, I think that he's just having a fucking blast writing this stuff.
Yes, he may have. Well, you know, I said that Rose, not Billy Piper, but Rose over-egged the pudding a bit. And I think Stephen Moffat could be declared guilty of over-egging the timey-wiminess.
Well, it's too many details. It's like, you know, I think he's throwing details in just as red herrings. I don't mind a couple red herrings, but, you know, a whole slew of them starts getting a little fishy.
How do you think, in comparison to RTD handling companions, how do you think, or what do you think the main difference is, and what do you like or dislike about how Stephen Moffat writes these companions for the Doctor? And go ahead, Chaz, you go first.
All right. Russell wrote characters who are nice people. Donna was a nice person. She was just kind of vapid. Rose was a nice person. She was poor. Mickey was a nice person, but he had no ambition. They're very, very nice people.
Nice people with character flaws.
And then bad things happen to them while they're in the company of the Doctor. Stephen writes damaged people. Who you could say complex, but you might also just say fucked up. let's just be blunt about it. And so, Clara is a perfect example of this. Here's this lovely actress who in any other era would have just been cast as a typical companion, a lovely girl. She had that lovely story of her parents meeting and all of that stuff. And instead, she gets this super complex backstory of being splintered through all time and space, like Count Scarleone. And it's a fair, I think it's a very fair criticism to say that We didn't need all that. That just, this is the too many details that you're talking about here. We don't need all that. She's just this girl. She's going with the doctor. He's nice. She's nice. Let's go.
And the whole time, the doctor's trying to figure that out. You know, everybody's saying, well, there's nothing really wrong with her. She seems human. She's just a regular girl.
Well, okay. Here's my criticism of the Moffat era women, and it is a problem with his women characters, definitely.
Uh-oh. Here we go.
That they are not people, they are puzzles.
Well, that's a fair, yeah.
I think that's a very heterosexual view there of a fella, you know?
Well, that's just, I think you're talking about a man who writes women because he's hoping to figure them out someday.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, I think RTD understands that women are just people. Without penises.
Well, that's because, you know, there's a big difference between the sexuality between RTD and Stephen Moffat.
That's true.
I will say in his defense, though, that I think Stephen did a beautiful job with Rory.
He did a great job because he wrote Rory as a person. He wasn't a puzzle. Well, he was kind of a puzzle, but he was also a person.
But he didn't have some deep, dark secret. He was just a very changed person by his experiences, which is great.
Yeah. And I liked River Song when she was in the library episodes. I thought she was really cool and kind of badass, and she became kind of, you know, the girlfriend.
She keeps becoming more impossible. You know, we call Clara the impossible girl.
It's
River Song that's actually the impossible girl.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and I think River, like I said, when we first meet River, that was in a story that was produced by RTD and script edited by Helen Rayner. So she was more of a person, and there were less complications to her. You just had an idea that she had known the doctor already. That was great. I liked that. That was really kind of cool. But then they just kind of started piling all these complications onto her, and she just kind of ended up being a girlfriend.
Still, with all the complications of these characters, they all really turn out to be fascinating characters. And they influence the Doctor in major, major ways.
And they still pull a surprise or two. Like, for everybody who didn't like Amy, and there's a great number of them who didn't, The Girl Who Waited was the episode where you have to reassess a little bit.
Oh, hell yeah.
You may still end up not liking her, but now you don't like her for different reasons.
Well, you know, the thing about that is, like, here you go. You see a great actress given good, great material and giving time to develop this because she's already developed her character, you know. Karen Gillan already developed Amy, and now she gets this juicy, juicy bit of Amy that they've never explored before. And of course, she's going to make the most of it. And that was really Karen Gillan at her all-time best, I think.
Well, it was actually the reason I love that episode a great deal is because it turns the RTD concept on its head. You mentioned earlier that RTD wrote a couple of stories actually about what happens to the people who get left behind. What happens to the companions post their time? And this was a flip of that where it all goes horribly wrong.
I'm one of those people who doesn't like Amy, and the reason I don't like her is because she's not a person, she's a puzzle. And I never really felt like she was a fully developed character. And I will disagree with you there. I mean,
I think she's
a person who things have happened to, but I don't see much coming out of her and into the world. Uh-huh. I see things happening to her.
Uh-huh. Because of her travels with the doctor.
Yeah, but uh-huh. I never felt any sympathy for her or any uh-huh. connection to her uh-huh. because she was a two-dimensional paper cutout.
Ooh.
With long legs.
We can certainly agree that Moffat's weakness is writing women.
Yeah.
If I could tell him five words, it would be write them as gay men.
And write them as gay men.
Yeah.
The problem.
It would.
That's funny.
Well, but then they'd. I don't know.
I thought that it was very obvious to me that series five, the introductory Matt Smith year, was much more comprehensively plotted with lots of callbacks and tiebacks and a story that had a beginning and a middle and an end and a lovely, juicy mystery of the Doctor, you know, fucking around in his own timeline a little bit. And I love those. The clues that we got in Time of Angels, for example, was just, I mean, this was all fairly delicious. It was a great debut episode. And even the lesser stories, this is the point I keep having to make to Doctor Who fans, you have to have lesser stories so that you know where the greater stories are. You cannot have a Pandorica opens every single time.
No, you
can't. Just, it's not tenable to do that. Oh. So you have to have, so you have to have an Amy's Choice. I'm sorry, but that's because this, because Doctor Who is a box of chocolates, to borrow a phrase. And Vincent and the Doctor...
Oh my God! Yeah, how amazing was that?
That had to be one of the dumbest alien monsters I've ever seen, and I love this episode completely.
That whole episode, it was so great on so many different levels. I mean, that was the way Doctor Who should be written. You know, it really should be, because yeah, it was a little heavy with the message, but you know, it had a nice message.
You can't. But again, you had to have the Lodger right after that, so that you. Because that's a fairly heavy episode, and then you go into something light.
Yeah.
You've got to have variety. That's the way it works.
And then, I felt
very satisfied when the Pandorica opened and the Big Bang came along. I was like, this story has been told from A to B.
Right.
And I feel like we got, yes, we took a timey-wimey way getting there, but then
we
the second...
with a big reset button.
Yeah, well, it's true. But there's a lot of... That's the whole thing about the Stephen Moffat era. There's so much resetting.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you have to, because you fucked up the universe so much. You got to have a reset or else you're just going to, yeah.
You know, and
you're in a mess.
And it's that's another reason why stories like the Van Gogh story was so nice. I don't think there was a reset button in that one. You know, I mean, you can take these simpler stories and make them work very nicely.
Here's the problem is I thought series 5 was very cohesive.
Uh-huh.
And it all made sense to me, and I didn't end up at the end of the season going, "What?" and then series 6, which was exactly, you know, apparently Stephen got the memo that maybe Series 5 was a little too complex. And so he split it up. The problem is that when you're a clever guy, you can't not be clever. But now he's just split it over the whole Amy's not really here. She's actually been kidnapped and River Song storyline.
Oh, I hated that. Oh.
It was a huge mess.
It was more, you know, Amy wasn't a person who did things. It was a person who things happened to, and she wasn't.
Well,
not even
a person anymore. She was.
She was
fake
a blow up doll.
Yeah, a doppelganger.
Well, she was literally a rebel flesh person, turns out. But even though in series 6 there are several really nice little episodes, which taken by themselves are nice, and I like them. But the quite a lot of them, in fact. But in particular, the Doctor's wife is the obvious highlight of that series. But then there's this complex plot line that's going on in the background, and I like to think of myself as a fairly clever and careful viewer. But I haven't watched Series 6 all the way through. I've watched each individual story, but I need to sit down and watch the whole thing to see if I can salvage some sense in there. Oh. But it didn't come across like Series 7. Series 6 was split into two parts, and you were left with nothing. It wasn't intended that way, and it doesn't work that way. Good Man Goes to War, you know, sort of ties up one end of things, but then it just goes off into, you have Let's Kill Hitler, Night Terrors, The Girl Who Waited, The God Complex, and Closing Time, and not one of these stories ties into anything else. They're all standalones. And it was just too disconnected. And then, on top of that, you had, I will be blunt, the worst Christmas special I've ever seen, associated with any show ever.
Was that the one with the shark?
No, the Doctor, the Widow, and the Wardrobe. The Sharknado one was much better.
I don't know about the Sharknado one.
I wasn't too keen on the shark.
Yeah.
Then Series 7 comes along, and it's split into two parts again, which leaves us with, we don't know what's, it just didn't allow the viewers to go from week to week connecting. Right. And I think that I really think that hurt the show. Neil Gaiman wrote Nightmare in Silver, and I just couldn't connect to it.
It was horrible.
Neil Gaiman.
You know what Nightmare in Silver reminded me of?
Well, he was probably just slipping it in between his regular job, you know.
There were some really good characterizations in that.
Yes.
And it was pretty fabulous. And they made the Cybermen a little bit something Cybermen are not really, you know.
Well, they introduced some concepts that I hope they'd carry forward, but I just didn't feel like it worked. Journey to the Center of the TARDIS was literally a one-line story. Let's explore the TARDIS. Nothing else, and then it could have been so much more.
Yeah, it could have. Oh, that was the biggest disappointment of the entire season to me.
Yeah, it was really disappointing.
Now, having just torn Series 6 and Series 7 a new one,
but you still love it, right?
That brings me to the name of the Doctor, which started off what I would like to think of as the revitalization of the show. I liked that episode very much. If careful viewing is well rewarded, particularly in light of Day of the Doctor and Time of the Doctor. Those three are actually a trilogy, and Name of the Doctor actually gets undone in that trilogy, but there you go. But I thought that was the... From there, we're now focused totally on the 50th anniversary and making the... concluding this arc that started in 2005.
Right. Wow.
And we're finally at the end of it with Time of the Doctor. And that's why I think, that's one of the reasons I am so excited about Capaldi, is not just him personally, although the tiny, I'm not going to spoil anything, tiny, tiny, tiny little trailers and things that we've seen already make me squeal like a little girl. But more than that, I think we're getting a new era. I can sense it. I can feel it. We're getting a whole new direction for the show. While there are plenty of iconic moments, even in Series 6 and Series 7, great lines, interesting characters, some good plots, lots of good individual elements, I didn't feel like those two series came together terribly well. This one, this new season, I think they've got a plan, so to speak. And I think they're actually going to execute the plan. That excites me more than anything else.
That's great. That's great. Now, let's put a cap on this.
I thought Series 5 was one of the most comprehensive and well-told season-long arcs I've ever seen in the show. Better than the key, more comprehensive than the Key to Time, in my view.
Wow.
It all just went pear-shaped after that. And although there's many individual moments, particularly due to the strength of Matt Smith's performance, that I can point to and say, I enjoyed this, I enjoyed that. As seasons, they did the story arcs didn't work, in my view, and just didn't quite hang together. Part of that was the break, but a lot of it was that they just didn't think it through as much. And maybe that's the pressure of constantly producing what is supposed to be flagship TV, you know, you run out of time, as Sylvester McCoy famously said.
Wow.
Ironically about that.
Funny.
I think that maybe this long break that we've had to endure before Capaldi comes on has hopefully recharged the batteries there.
Yeah, actually, let's get into a little speculation. Who do you think's going to take over after Moffat?
Oh, good Lord.
Well, the conventional wisdom would be Mark Gatiss.
Yeah,
because he is a successful television writer. He would certainly be. I mean, Sherlock has proven, and Sherlock is. I should have come back to that earlier. Is you can clearly see the influence Sherlock is having on Doctor Who, but has always had to some extent. But I mean, really lately. So Mark Gatiss seems the logical and obvious choice. But I'm still going to pull for Paul Cornell because I know Paul and I like him and I know he'd be great. Especially if you want to return to the more emotional themes of the Russell T. Davis era, Paul Cornell is your man.
Let's go, but, Gary Russell. Gary Russell.
But, Well, you know, Gary Russell is certainly doing, he's in Australia working on animated stuff these days, but he certainly has enough of a background that he would be a valuable asset. Oh, he was part of the production team at one point. So on Doctor Who, he served as script editor on some stories. So he's certainly a candidate as well. But this is the thing, is maybe what the show really needs is somebody who's who wasn't a fanboy first and is a TV producer first. Maybe the show needs a grown-up.
Thank you, Chaz. Thank you, Nancy. It's time for us to go. We got to get on out of here. Gang, it's been fun. Hope you've enjoyed our overgeneralizations of the past
<It's true.
laughs> 10 years or so. If you want a little more of Doctor Who nattering about, look for the Happiness Patrol on iTunes. You can subscribe to us there. Leave us a little comment if you like the show. If you don't like the show, what, you know, anything at all. Hopefully, if you like the show.
If you think we should just shut up.
Yeah, if you want us to just shut up, that's cool too. And
that'll never happen.
Also, look for our back issues on the blog spot that we have, the happinesspatrol.blogspot.com, I believe. Did I get that correct, Nancy?
Yep.
Yeah, I think I did. Yay, how about that? And we're also on Twitter. Nancy?
Mm-hmm. We are at the H Patrol.
Follow us at the H Patrol. And we're all over the Book of Faith, so come over there and say hey and like us. If you like us, you like us.
You're never off of Facebook.
Seriously. Huh? If you'd like to come see us live, you have some opportunities this year to do that.
Yes, you do.
Yes. In particular, in very late October, early November, we will be at Hurricane Who in Orlando, Florida. And then just a week or so later, we're going up to Long Island.
We're going
for
to New York.
Long Island Iced Tea Who.
New York. I'm going to New York. Can you stand it? Kids, this Southern boy is going to New York.
I've never been to New York. I mean, I've been to upstate New York, but I've never been to New York proper. City.
Yes. So that's going to be an adventure right there. We're going to be there.
And, of course, at least some of us will certainly be at Gallifrey again next year.
Yes.
So you have plenty of opportunities, and we're very anxious to meet all of you and also to get more fantastic IDs from people like Paul McGann with Mr. Sexy Voice. Did you listen to the last episode?
Did you enjoy that? I'm glad you liked that.
Yes. We were all like melty at the very beginning there. Paul McGann.
So anyway, we're going to get on out of here. So until next time, gang. Oh, wait a minute. You know what? We got to say, Michelle, we miss you because we do.
I know.
We miss you, Michelle. Okay, until next time, we are all excited about Peter Capaldi coming on the screen on August 23rd. So stand by. We will be joining you sometime around that time. And until then, I am Louis B.
I'm Nancy A.
I'm Chaz M.
And we're all excited about Peter Capaldi.
Capaldi!
See you guys later. Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to the Happiness Patrol.
When it's time to change, you've got to rearrange who you are and what you're gonna be. Sha na 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 na. Sha na 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 na.
The Brady Kids.
The Brady Kids. The Sid and Marty Krofft thing that they did in the '70s with the Brady Bunch.
Turning them into a musical variety act.
Oh yeah.
I don't remember that at all.
Oh, you're probably better off. You're probably blocking it.
But I probably like watched one episode and said bleh.
Yeah, probably.
Oh yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So there you go.
Pink Lady and Jeff.
Well, that was something.
Wow. You are
tickling
that.
Brain cells best left sleeping.
You probably am. Okay. So here we go.
Post-traumatic Skype disorder. That's it.
There you go.